and alive. He may let one get by now and then, but he believes even the worst of men is entitled to a fair shake. Also, the court does not pay any fees for dead men. Quinn is a good peace officer and a lay preacher to boot. He won't plant evidence or abuse a prisoner. He is as straight as a string. Yes, I will say Quinn is about the best they have. I said, "Where can I find this rooster?" Movie fans will call to mind the aging John Wayne, who famously portrayed Rooster Cogburn on the screen. But the rooster of the novel is somewhat younger, in his late 40s. A fat, one-eyed character with walrus mustaches, unwashed, malarial, drunk much of the time. He is a veteran of the Confederate Army, and, more particularly, of William Clark Quantrill's Bloody Border Gang, notorious in American history for the massacre at Lawrence, Kansas, and also for launching the careers of the teenaged Frank and Jesse James. Matty runs Rooster to ground in his squalid rented room at the back of a Chinese grocery store. "Men will live like billy goats if they are let alone," she remarks disapprovingly. And he's happy enough to take Maddie's money to ride out after her father's killer, but not to let Maddie come along. He sat up in the bed.
"Wait," he said. "Hold up. You are not going."
"That is part of it," said I.
"It cannot be done."
"And why not? You have misjudged me if you think I am silly enough to give you $100 and watch you ride away. No, I will see the thing done myself." Matty is not the only party after Tom Chaney. So is a vain, good-looking Texas Ranger named LaBeef, who has already tracked Chaney over several states. LaBeef, whose name is spelled LaBeouf, and who is somewhat overly proud of his membership in the Rangers, wants to team up with Rooster to bring Chaney back alive and collect the bounty. But the dandy LaBeef, clanking along in his great brutal spurs and Texas trappings, is no more interested than Rooster in allowing a 14-year-old girl to tag along on a manhunt. Moreover, LaBeef's intent is to bring Chaney back to Texas to hang for killing a Texas state senator in a dispute over a bird dog, a claim which Matty hotly disputes.
"Ho, ho," said LaBeef. "It is not important where he hangs, is it?"
"It is to me. Is it to you?"
"It means a good deal of money to me.
Would not a hanging in Texas serve as well as a hanging in Arkansas?" "No. You said yourself they might turn him loose down there. This judge will do his duty."
"If they don't hang him, we will shoot him. I can give you my word as a ranger on that."
"I want Chaney to pay for killing my father and not some Texas bird dog."
"It will not be for the dog. It will be for the senator and your father, too. He will be just as dead that way, you see, and pay for all his crimes at once."
"No, I do not see. That is not the way I look at it." Not surprisingly, Rooster and LaBeef contrive to slip away from Fort Smith without Matty. But she strikes out after them, and as hard as they ride, they cannot lose her. Finally, when they cannot get Matty to turn back, they accept her. First, in anger, as a worrisome tag-along, then, grudgingly, as a mascot and equal of sorts. And finally, as she stands among them and proves herself, as a relentless force in her own right. Like Huckleberry Finn, or The Catcher in the Rye, or even the Bertie and Jeeves stories for that matter, True Grit is a monologue, and the great, abiding pleasure of it that compels the reader to return to it again and again is Matty's voice. No living Southern writer captures the spoken idioms of the South as artfully as Portis does, but though in all his novels, including those set in the current day, Portis shows his deep understanding of place, True Grit also masters the more complicated subtleties of time. Matty, having survived her youthful adventure, is recounting her story as an old woman. and Portis is such a genius of a literary mimic that the book reads less like a novel than a first-hand account. The Wild West of the 1870s, as recollected in a spinster's memory and filtered through the sedate sepia tones of the early 1900s. Maddie's narrative tone is naive, didactic, hard-headed, and completely lacking in self-consciousness, and, at times, unintentionally hilarious, rather in the manner of Daisy Ashford's The Young Visitors. And like The Young Visitors, which is largely delightful because it views the most absurd Victorian crotchets as obvious common sense, a great part of True Grit's charm is in Maddie's blasé view of frontier America. Shootings, stabbings, and public hangings are recounted frankly and flatly, and often with rather less warmth than the political and personal opinions upon which Maddie digresses. She quotes scripture, she explains and gives advice to the reader. Her observations are often overlaid with a decorative glaze of Sunday school piety. And her own very distinctive voice, blunt, unsentimental, yet salted with parlor platitudes, echoes throughout the reported speech of all the other characters, lawmen and outlaws alike, to richly comic effect, as when Rooster remarks austerely of a young prisoner he has brought back alive to stand trial. "I should have put a ball in that boy's head instead of his collarbone. I was thinking about my fee. You will sometimes let money interfere with your notion of what is right." Maddie is often compared to her literary ancestor, Huckleberry Finn. But though the two of them share some obvious similarities, in most respects, Maddie is a much harder customer than careless, sweet-tempered Huck. Where Huck is barefoot and uncivilized, living happily in his hogshead barrel, Maddie is a pure product of civilization, as a Sunday school teacher in 19th century Arkansas might define it. She is a straight-laced Presbyterian, prim as a poker. "I would not put a thief in my mouth to steal my brains," she says coolly to the drunken Rooster. Tidy, industrious, frugal, with a head for figures and a shrewd business sense. Her deadpan manner is reminiscent of Buster Keaton. Maddie, too, is a great stone face. She never cracks a smile when recounting the undignified and ridiculous situations in which she finds herself. And even predicaments of great danger fail to draw violent emotion from her. But this deadpan flatness serves a double purpose in the novel. For if Maddie is humorless, she is also completely lacking in qualities like pity and self-doubt. And her implacable stoniness, while very, very funny, is formidable, too, in a manner reminiscent of old tintypes and carte de visites of Confederate soldier boys, dead-eye killers with rumpled hair and serious angel faces. One cannot picture Huckleberry Finn in the same light, for while Huck is an adventuresome spirit, duty and discipline are wholly foreign to him. Conscripted by any army, any cause, he would desert in short order, slipping away the first chance he got to his easy riverbank life. Maddie, on the other hand, is the perfect soldier, despite her sex. She is as tireless as a gun dog, and while we laugh at her single-mindedness, we also stand in awe of it. In her Old Testament morality, in her legalistic and exacting turn of mind, in the thunderous blackness of her wrath, she is less Huck Finn's little sister than Captain Ahab's. True Grit is an adventure story, and though the two books in most respects could not be more different, Maddie's quest in some ways reflects Dorothy Gale's in The Wizard of Oz. Practical Dorothy, throughout all her trials, is really only working her way back home to Kansas, while practical Maddie, with her own mission and her own brace of unlikely traveling companions, is riding in the historical shadow of a very different Kansas, the mythical outlaw territory of Quantrill and his Confederate raiders. While Quantrill, a brilliant tactician, was romanticized in some quarters as an outlaw chieftain a la Alexandre Dumas, the massacre he led at the abolitionist town of Lawrence, Kansas, is considered the worst atrocity of the American Civil War, and history has tended to view Quantrill as a cold-blooded killer. One man, shot 5 times when he tried to surrender, was left for dead by his assailant with the parting advice, "Tell old God that the last man you saw on earth was Quantrill." Rooster, presumably, has come by some of his famous meanness under Quantrill's tutelage. The incident with Otis Wharton and the bodies in the fire does seem to have some parallels with unpleasant incidents in historical accounts of raids at Lawrence and Centralia. And certainly he has picked up Quantrill's reputed habit of riding against his enemy with the reins of his horse between his teeth and a revolver in each hand. And yet it is scoundrelly old Rooster who, like Huck Finn, revolting instinctively against the accepted brutality of his day, rises unexpectedly to True Grit's moments of justice and nobility. He does this in a number of minor comical respects, as in his satisfying encounter with the 2 wicked boys who are tormenting the mule on the riverbank, not to mention the novel's extraordinary climax. But perhaps the most gratifying moment in the entire book is when he is jolted from his ambivalence about Mattie by the sight of LaBeef falling upon her with a switch.
"I began to cry. I could not help it, but more from anger and embarrassment than pain. I said to Rooster, 'Are you going to let him do this?' He dropped his cigarette to the ground and said, 'No, I don't believe I will. Put your switch away, LaBeef. She's got the best of us.' 'She has not got the best of me,' replied the ranger. Rooster said, 'That will do,' I said." LaBeef paid him no heed. Rooster raised his voice and said, "Put that switch down, LaBeef. Do you hear me talking to you?" LaBeef stopped and looked at him. Then he said, "I am going ahead with what I started." Rooster pulled his cedar-handled revolver and cocked it with his thumb and threw down on LaBeef. He said, "It will be the biggest mistake you ever made, you Texas brush popper."
True Grit, in short, begins where chivalry meets the frontier, where the old Confederacy starts to merge and shade away into the Wild West. And, without giving anything away, I can say that the book ends at a traveling Wild West show in Memphis in the early 1900s, which is to say, at once in the 20th century and firmly enshrined in American myth and legend. True Grit was first published in 1968. When it came out, Roald Dahl wrote that it was the best novel to come his way in a long time. I was going to say it was the best novel to come my way since, then I stopped. Since what? What book has given me greater pleasure in the last 5 years, or in the last 20? Certainly, when I was growing up, in the 1970s, True Grit was widely thought to be a classic. When I was about 14 years old, it was read along with Walt Whitman and Nathaniel Hawthorne and Edgar Allan Poe in the honors English classes at my school. Yet, because, I believe, of the John Wayne film, which is good enough but which doesn't do the book justice, True Grit vanished from the public eye, and my mother and I, along with many other Portis fans, were reduced to scouring used bookstores and buying up whatever stock we could find because the copies we lent out so evangelically were never returned. In one particularly dark moment, when my mother's last copy had disappeared and a new one was nowhere to be had, she borrowed the library's copy and then pretended she had lost it. Now, thankfully, the book is back in print. I have had this book read aloud to me several times over the years by beloved family members, and, believe it or not, this is actually not the first time I have read this book aloud myself. As delightful as it is to read on the page, it's just as wonderful to hear. And this is why I'm so happy to have the honor of narrating the first audiobook version of True Grit, and of introducing Mattie Ross and Rooster Cogburn to a new generation of readers and listeners.
That was Donna Tartt on True Grit by Charles Portis. This essay was originally written as the foreword to the Bloomsbury edition of this book.